From NPR News and WBUR, I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. A record number of women are running for Congress or governor this year. And yesterday, the U.S. Senate made a historic change that reflects the times. Members voted unanimously to change their tradition-bound rules to allow senators to bring a baby under the age of one into the Senate chamber during a vote. The new rule comes after Illinois Democrat and Iraq War veteran Tammy Duckworth this month became the first U.S. senator in office to give birth. And Senate rules require members to vote in person inside the chamber. Senator Amy Klobuchar is a Democrat from Minnesota who helped bring about the rules change. Senator, what was your role in this?
I am the ranking on rules. I head up the Rules Committee along with Senator Roy Blunt, the Republican of Missouri. So it was our job to get every senator to agree to this because we couldn't take a whole week voting on it on the floor. And Tammy Duckworth and I felt really strongly that the legacy Tammy should leave, among many other things, is that it wasn't just an exception for her, that it would apply to all women in men in the future, because if we're going to have a more work-friendly, family-friendly place in the Senate, we don't want it just be for one mom. We want it to be for everyone, and we should be an example for the country.
And just to reiterate, you said there, this applies to moms and dads.
It applies to moms and dads. That was, by the way, an issue that I had to overcome. Someone suggested we just have it be for moms, and I said that doesn't really make any sense. The argument is we have these late-night votes at 11 and midnight and 3 in the morning, and oftentimes you don't get much notice. And there you are. She has another child that shouldn't be dragged in. It's just really not easy, even with a spouse, because everything's so last minute in the middle of the night.
So if you had to do a lot of arm twisting, or at least a lot of canvassing before this, what were the questions that were asked of you, and what kind of convincing did you have to do?
Well, it was pretty funny because you've heard some of them in the last few days. Some of the senators have publicly said their concerns. One of the senators said, well, what if there's 10 babies on the floor?
That was Orrin Hatch who said that.
And I said, well, that'd be great. That'd be delightful, actually, if we had that many senators, men and women, that had young babies. That might be good for the whole place. Not to mention, with all the gridlock, a lot of babies on the floor could be helpful.
How about in terms of the reality of babies needing attention and needing it right away? You know, it's distracting, and you got a lot of serious business to attend to on the floor.
Well, but that doesn't mean that she couldn't go somewhere else if the baby started to cry. Remember, this is just during the votes, and so she'd be holding the baby. She can walk out in the hallway or walk in the cloakroom or do something, or in her case, in a wheelchair. She can go to another room if the baby's crying. There's plenty of places to go. She just has to be able to be there when she votes.
I see. So during actual debate,
She can be there during the vote time, which may include the debate, depending on how many votes we have in a row.
Okay. What other kind of pushback did you get?
Okay. So one of the more amusing ones, I said, well, why doesn't she just vote from the cloakroom, hide the baby, hold the baby, and vote around the corner? Because sometimes people do that, you know, if they're sick or something. So Tammy Duckworth lost both her legs for our country, and she's in a wheelchair. And the cloakrooms are not wheelchair accessible. You have to go upstairs unless you go through the Senate floor. So I said to them, well, the only way she can get to the cloakroom is through the Senate floor. So then they would say, well, why doesn't she have a staff member hold a baby? Then I would say, well, do we want to change the rules to say that staff members are supposed to be babysitting babies during the day? I really don't think we want to go there. So that broke down those arguments, but there's still discussion about why doesn't she vote from the cloakroom. Another question I got was about changing diapers and breastfeeding. Can you imagine me talking about this with a number of older senators? I did. But the issue is that she's not interested in doing that, so we didn't really even get to that on the Senate floor. Okay, then the very last one was questions about if the baby was going to have to comply with the dress code of the Senate. Now, some of that was in jest, but for instance, you have to wear pants or a skirt, and you can't wear a little cap or a hat, and you can't wear sneakers, and you can't wear flip-flops, but we have made an exemption for the baby. So the baby doesn't have to comply with the dress code.
Okay. As you said, some of that was made in jest, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
This is a watershed moment for the U.S. Senate. There are people who are running for office right now, some women who are running for office. We've noticed some political ads that show the candidates breastfeeding on camera while they're talking about their candidacies. There are other countries' parliaments, for instance. New Zealand's parliament has for decades allowed
breastfeeding on the floor. An Australian member of parliament became the first MP to breastfeed on the Senate floor. We're not just talking about breastfeeding, but you said that's what some of the members have brought up. Do you think that's next? Will that be an issue?
I wouldn't rule that out at all. It would just depends on what the next mom would want to do. But right now, that's not what Tammy wants to do. So it's not an issue, which is I assured them. But I think it's very plausible we could allow that at some point. Remember, the Senate rules are not easy to change. We have not allowed for more access to the floor since 1977. That was the last time it happened when service dogs were allowed. So one of the arguments I was able to make was that we allowed dogs on the floor. So maybe we could allow a baby. And there's only been 52 women in the Senate, and there have been, by the way, over 1,900 men. So times are finally changing, and we got to get with it.
If it's happening in the Senate, there are lots of other places.
So the argument we want to make is this isn't just about these 100 people and our archaic rules and a weird work schedule where you work often at 2 in the morning. But what this is about is changing workplaces across America in terms of work-family leave and child care. And if we can't make this minor rule change in the Senate, how are we going to change the law to match a lot of other industrialized nations where we actually have good child care policies and work family leave? We're not there yet in America, and we have a strong economy right now, and a lot of our businesses need workers. And if we're going to get there, we have to start offering our workers the ability to work while they have kids.
Senator, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat from Minnesota, speaking to us about the new rule that allows Senate members to bring infants to the chamber during floor votes.
Amazon now has more than 100 million customers using Prime. That's the online retail giant subscription service that gives users free two-day delivery and access to streaming video and music offerings. CEO Jeff Bezos announced that number of customers, a long-kept secret, in a letter to shareholders yesterday. Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One. Hi, Robin.
Good day. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So Prime users pay $99 a year. Bezos said that in 2017, the company added more subscribers than any other year. What do you think's driving that uptick?
I got to tell you, I'm old enough to remember, like, I was in college and people would look at me like, you know, you dork with your Amazon delivery and your book. How cute is that? You got a compact disc from Amazon. Why don't you just go across the street to the Borders and buy it, you numbnut? But what happened was now it's people are realizing that this is the default position. This truly is the everything store. I mean, you talk about Amazon Prime. It now has more subscribers than Costco. The retention rate, even as they up the price, is more than 90%. And this stat blew my mind. There are 126 million households in the United States. 55% subscribe to Amazon Prime.
Wow, that's a lot. I mean, that has to be about, you know, more than the subscription fee. This is, you know, partly about loyalty. What do you think's driving that success? I mean, Amazon's getting people to pony up where other companies aren't.
Because they're folding all sorts of stuff into it. I mean, it's one thing if you look at it as kind of a Costco-like thing where they're taking your chunky membership fee and amortizing it over their lower prices. In this case, you've come not only to expect free shipping coming out of the Great Recession, but in Amazon's case, shows like Transparent, access to old Showtime things. They throw in bonuses every now and then, like a free MP3 here and there. There's the new ownership of Whole Foods and Amazon Prime, cross-selling and discounts there. And everybody on Wall Street right now is really big into subscription businesses. You've seen it with Netflix's numbers and Spotify's numbers, and Amazon with this, you know, 100 million subscriber curiosity is this whole new threat.
So the shareholder letter ran through other stuff as well, other highlights over the last year. I mean, what did it tell you? What stuck out to you? What else stuck out, you know, about how big and fast the company has expanded?
I look at this company and what do you value it as? A retailer? As a media disruptor? As an XYZ? I just think Jeff Bezos, the founder and CEO, he gets this very unique position on Wall Street that you know, they called it with Steve Jobs the reality distortion force field. Whatever this guy goes out and innovates in, forget the margins in the near term. This is a long-term company. Stick with me. I'm going to make it right. It would have been laughable to think about a movie studio coming out of Amazon years ago. It would have been ridiculous to think about them buying Whole Foods. Now they're suddenly worth three Walmarts.
Wow. So the letter didn't mention President Trump, who has repeatedly criticized Amazon on Twitter and elsewhere. I mean, the latest case being President Trump's claim that Amazon is abusing the U.S. Postal Service. I mean, does President Trump pose any kind of threat to Amazon's growth in 2018, or is this just an annoying Twitter thing for the company?
I posit that there's billionaire envy. I mean, Jeff Bezos, as of today, and by the way, the stock is up like 31% this year, which is already enormous for a multi-billion dollar company.
Wow.
Jeff Bezos is worth $127 billion. He's the richest guy. He happens to own the Washington Post, which Donald Trump and his White House don't have much love for. And it's a useful canard to kind of bring in that you're bankrupting the Postal Service. In reality, when you look at the numbers, the Postal Service would be in a lot of trouble right now were it not for Amazon's huge dollars pouring in.
And very briefly, do Prime members spend more? They must, right? Than other customers?
Yeah, quite a bit more. There are a couple of estimates. One analyst on Wall Street said that Prime members, he figures, spend about $1,300 a year, where non-members spend a little more than half that. And the number is only broadening.
Great. Robin Farzad hosts Full Disclosure on NPR One. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
If you're the parent of an infant, you know how many kinds of diapers there are out there. High absorbency, breathable, eco-friendly, or chemical-free. The options seem endless. Problem is, they're all pricey. And in the U.S., one out of every three families struggles to afford any kind of baby diaper. Joanne Goldblum has seen the problem firsthand. She's executive director of the National Diaper Bank Network based in New Haven, Connecticut. Welcome, Joanne.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
The notion that one in three American families struggles to afford diapers is astonishingly high. Is it really that common?
When you think about the numbers related to poverty and low income in America, it's not that surprising because 44% of American children live in poor or low income families. So it really is not surprising when you look at the income levels in our country.
How did this first come to your attention? How did you even catch on to this?
So I'm a social worker, and about 14 years ago, I was doing community-based social work. So I went into people's homes in New Haven, and I saw a level of poverty that really surprised me, even as somebody who thought that they really understood what poverty in America looked like. And so I saw over and over again families that struggled to meet their basic needs, and that included diapers. I saw parents empty solids out and put the diaper back on the baby, try to dry out a disposable diaper. And as I began to research the issue, it became clear to me that there really weren't a lot of people thinking about this or talking about it.
So if you break it down, we've estimated the diapers cost about 20 cents each. And when you're going through massive amounts of diapers every day, every week, every month, that really does add up. Is the problem that the cost of diapers has gone up, or that assistance has gone down and that incomes have gone down?
So I believe it has much more to do with income. Since the advent of welfare reform in 1996, the amount of money people who are poor have has decreased significantly. So we used to have a safety net that was available to families for however long they needed it. We no longer have that because with the implementation of temporary assistance for needy families, we now have time limits so that families, after a certain amount of time, don't have access to cash assistance.
Would it be helpful from many perspectives, maybe even including ecological, if we went back to using cloth diapers? Could more people then afford diapers?
So that's a really good question. For some families who are struggling, that could be an answer. But for families who don't have access to laundry facilities in their home, it's really a very difficult thing to manage. And also for families who are working sometimes two or three jobs and different shifts, you know, cloth requires a lot of at-home support. The other thing I would say is when it comes to the environmental issue, the jury is sort of still out. Even
because it takes water and use of detergent when you wash diapers.
Exactly.
So in this country, when you have lower income families who really struggle to find the money to purchase diapers, I imagine in some cases even adult diapers, what kind of an effect does it have on the family?
So it's interesting. It actually has a very significant effect. We recently did a study with the Connecticut, a Center for Economic Analysis, and the Connecticut Diaper Bank, and looked at the economic impact that diapers had. And what we found is that one in three households who rely on childcare have to miss work sometimes if they don't have diapers. So more than half of the parents using childcare have missed work because of an inadequate supply of diapers. So for families that get diapers from a diaper bank, they're able to work and go to school and do other things more regularly.
Are there other resources aside from diaper banks?
So right now, diaper banks are the most significant resource. There are some states that are looking at different ways to address this issue. In California last year, they passed a bill that will begin to give CalWORKs, so people who receive certain benefits in the state, $30 a month per child for diapers. And there are some other states that have been looking at doing programs like that. And we actually have a federal bill that was introduced by Representative DeLauro and Ellison to try to add a benefit for diapers to families.
Joanne Goldblum, Executive Director of the National Diaper Bank Network based in New Haven, Connecticut. Joanne, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Let's look at another problem that affects low-income families, finding an affordable place to live. Agencies that work with poor families often rely on motels to keep people off the streets and out of shelters. Some people live in motels for months or years because they can't save up for a regular rental. And that's led to a pushback in communities where leaders argue that long-term motel stays rob them of tax dollars, violate zoning laws, are unsafe, and create pockets of crime and poverty. One small town in Colorado has taken steps to stop the practice. Colorado Public Radio's Michael Elizabeth Sackis reports on the outcome.
The mile-and-a-half road that connects Colorado Springs with the resort town of Manitou Springs is known as No Man's Land. The short stretch is dotted with aging, mid-century motels, but it's getting a major overhaul to fight its rundown reputation.
For 2 years now, I've been trying to find a real rental.
That's Leslie Phipps. She lived in a motel down the road for over a year, but had to leave after Manitou Springs decided lodges can only rent 20% of their rooms long-term. The rest have to be nightly. After living with her daughter, she's back in a local motel. This time, she can only stay for 30 days.
If they'd let me stay, I would even start a garden out back. But there's no stability in it, you know? And if you start a garden, what if you get run off?
Phipps says she thought she had found stability. She's been working her job as a line cook in Manitou for 2 years, and her 16-year-old son is in the district's high school. She's on a wait list for an apartment, but is afraid that, with two bedrooms renting for around $1,300, she can't save up for the first month's rent and a deposit, things that aren't needed to get a motel room.
You don't have any extra when you have to live like this.
People have been living in Manitou's motels for decades. The schools included bus stops along No Man's Land to pick up kids. But the city decided to enforce its maximum stay ordinance about a year and a half ago. Wade Burkholder is Manitou's city planning director.
The health, safety, and welfare is what we're here to protect was becoming more and more a concern for us.
Burkholder says many of the motels aren't suitable for long-term stays. There are no stoves for cooking or kitchen sinks for dishes. But even those already converted to be more like apartments have to return to nightly rentals, since they're not zoned as residential. Burkholder says motel owners aren't happy with the change.
We now have three properties that are unfortunately sitting vacant because of this new rule.
The city will also make money from a lodging tax that can't be collected on longer stays. But one motel manager says he's still renting long-term because he'd be out of business if he didn't, that tourists don't want to stay at his rundown lodge. Burkholder says at first the city was forcing tenants out, but they realized people needed more time to transition.
I think we learned that we have to be more proactive and not just go in there and heavy hand, lock the doors on people.
Agencies will often place families in motels to keep them out of shelters. Kathy Alderman is with the Colorado Coalition for the Homeless. She says the state has very few options for what she calls bridge housing, a place someone can stay as they wait for something more permanent.
Motels are sometimes the only option for folks who need an emergency situation. And if that's being restricted, I don't know where these families are expected to go.
She says living conditions might not be ideal, but the alternative is worse.
It doesn't do the community any good to evict people from these situations if they don't have any other place to go. They're just going to end up back on the streets, accessing emergency services.
Manitou doesn't have a homeless shelter. Planning Director Wade Burkholder says the people who lived in the motels likely had to leave the city and go to nearby Colorado Springs. The school district lost 88 students when they started to enforce the ordinance. Amy Cox is the CEO of the nonprofit Community Health Partnership and a former council member in Manitou. She says this is a black eye on the city and that officials should reevaluate the ordinance.
The trauma experienced by children who are uprooted from their home and their school and forced out of their community, that carries forward.
The school district wouldn't comment, but in a letter to Cox, Manitou Superintendent Ed Longfield says he talked with the city about how this ordinance would impact its at-risk families. Longfield says they've worked to keep the kids in school, including sending buses across Colorado Springs, but that displaced families find it hard to keep their kids in a different district. Leslie Phipps says her son is one reason she's trying to stay in Manitou. She doesn't want him to leave his school. But Phipps adds that motels aren't a good place to raise kids.
But this is my only option right now. And if my whole paycheck has to go toward this place, that's what'll happen.
When her 30 days are up, Phipps says she'll likely move to another motel. She points to her car and says she and her son might also spend a few nights in there, too. For Here and Now, I'm Michael Elizabeth Sackis.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
About 70% of U.S. households have pets, reptiles, birds, and cats, but the leaders of the pack are dogs. Dogs are found in some 60 million homes. And as Christina Estes reports from member station KJZZ in Phoenix, that's changing the way homes are being designed and built.
We are going to go look at our dog park so you can see how fun that is.
Dogs and fun weren't used in the same sentence when Sandy McKee began her career in multifamily housing 25 years ago.
We had separate pet buildings. Pets were not welcome. Owners did not want the mess, maybe, or the carpet replacement. There was a lot of cost involved to owners, and they just didn't want to deal with that.
Today, communities like the 286-unit complex McKee manages in Glendale cater to people with pets.
We have to welcome pets if we're going to increase our rentals. And back in the day when we didn't do that, I don't think they realized how many rentals they lost being that way.
The Bel Air community was designed nearly 2 years ago with dogs in mind. From the canine agility course,
hoops and barrel to jump through, and the balls and the frisbees and all of that,
to the 24-hour dog spa.
Basically a big bath area for them so they don't have to do that in their apartment home and all the mess that comes with that. The fur dryers are provided.
Like most apartment complexes, Bel Air doesn't allow breeds identified as aggressive by some insurance companies. And while there's no size restriction, they do limit pets to 2 per unit.
We have about 25% of our residents having pets.
Surveys show millennials, those between 24 and 38 years old, are the most likely to own pets. Angela Roth is part of that generation.
This is Pierre. He's a little over a year old, and he is our little fur baby.
When Roth and her husband brought their 9-week-old French bulldog home, the townhouse felt a bit crowded, so house hunting kicked into high gear with a focus on Pierre.
Still looking for things that he would appreciate, like a yard and space for his toys and his kennel and all the things that you would think about with a baby, but for a dog.
Now that they've nearly doubled their space, Pierre can spread out his toys and race up and down stairs whenever he wants. But before they moved in, the Ross went shopping with Pierre in mind. Or more precisely, a piece of Pierre in their pocket. They collected some of his fur, stuck it on a piece of tape, and carried it with them to pick out flooring and furniture that would hide his fur.
We certainly got the looks at both the design studio and the furniture store, and even Home Depot picking out some of the finishes, going, "What are they doing with that piece of tape?" But it has paid off greatly, because he can be on the furniture and us not have to worry, and we don't have to worry about sweeping every single corner before guests come over.
Dog beds and bowls are what Eric Tinker's clients most want to hide. He builds sleeping cubbies in laundry rooms and feeding stations in kitchens.
To keep just keeping the food and the bowls off the ground so nobody does trip, or, you know, it is an eyesore a little bit. So people are kind of hiding that into the cabinetry.
As pets get older, they can require accommodations just like people. Some homeowners request walk-in bathing areas and elevators to help four-legged family members get around. At a property on the slopes of the Phoenix Mountain Preserve, Tinker says a special area will be added.
So they built out a custom deck just for the dog to be able to have a play yard and off the side of the house.
And Tinker is ready to start building what he believes will be the next big trend, designer dog homes.
Sky's the limit with those.
For Here and Now, I'm Christina Estes in Phoenix.
When Andrew Sean Greer's Less first came out, reviewer Ron Charles of the Washington Post asked, "Do we really need another novel about a novelist?" To which he then answered, "Yes, this one is delightful." Now Less has won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. The book's hero, appropriately named Arthur Less, is overshadowed by the acclaimed poet he lived with for years, just less than a successful lover. His most recent partner left him to marry another man. He's about to turn 50 when his agent informs him his new novel isn't being picked up. And a friend helpfully points out, it's not because he's a bad writer, it's because he's a bad gay. Robin Young spoke with Andrew Sean Greer when the novel was first published.
Look, your character Arthur's book, the one that's been rejected, has a character that's wandering San Francisco. You have a character in Arthur wandering the world. Halfway around, he blows up his book, rewrites it. So, of course, I'm wondering, is some of Arthur you, the author? Wondering if you also fought with some of those same issues of, like, this book, I got to tear it apart.
Absolutely. I think, of course, an author writing about an author is that Ron Charles wrote, is the last thing anyone wants to read about, and writers should never do it. But I think after a couple books, they let you have one of these. You have fun with the whole thing, because what do you actually do all the time but write? And then you're supposed to write about, like, a jailbreak or something, and I have to research it. So it was fun to dig into my own anxieties.
Well, yeah, talk about that. Well, who is Arthur Less? Which, by the way, everybody says around the world, like, who the hell is Arthur Less?
Well, he's nobody. That is the whole thing. He's been attached to a genius, and he's had some amount of success in his own career. But really, by middle age, if you haven't had great success, you're kind of invisible in some way. He's full of self-doubt, and yet, strangely, he has a childlike hope for the future, which leads him to take on these bizarre projects around the world that he says yes to, which, of course, only gets him into trouble.
Oh, it's so painful. Because of his status as an almost famous author, he gets invitations to interview others, to speak in France. He's part of some sort of American outreach reading program. He reads aloud to coal miners, and he's thinking, what on earth was everyone thinking, bringing a mid-list homosexual to read to French coal miners? He teaches in Germany for a while, and you use this great technique letting us hear the translation of what he thinks is his good German. And for instance, he meets his students and says, "Hello, I have to kill you," or something like that.
That was super fun to write. I know no German, so that wasn't based on me at all. But I thought in so many books we make fun of people with funny accents in English. I thought, imagine how funny we sound in other languages.
Well, we get to hear. He gets impaled on a sewing needle in India, trapped in a sandstorm in Morocco. At one point, falls on his knees. As you write, he has nothing left, our gay Job. Was there something, biblical as well as Homeric here, somebody setting off on a journey?
I hadn't thought about it as biblical until I realized that I'd tortured my poor character until he had nothing left, just because I found it funny. I just kept thinking, what other kind of vanity can I strip away from him?
What did his friend mean when he said to him, it's not that you're a bad writer, you're a bad gay? What was that?
Well, now I do have to admit that someone said that to me years ago.
What?
And I just have puzzled over it for years. And so then I thought, I'll just have someone say it in the book and mystify Arthur himself. I think it's something about you're supposed to have sort of like a propaganda for the political movement rather than people by complicated characters that you may not particularly like, and sometimes you like the villains and that kind of stuff in literature, that I wasn't doing it right, which, I mean, God knows, I'm sure I'm not doing something right here, but I don't know if that's it.
Well, in this case, his friend Finley was trying to point out that in all of his books, he depicts gays who are, you know, suffering. Here's Finley. It's our duty to show something beautiful from our world, the gay world. But in your books, you make the characters suffer without reward. If I didn't know better, I'd think you were Republican. you know, books filled with self-hating. Is that part of what maybe someone meant to you?
Yeah, I think they were trying to tell me that I was just too mean to the gay characters and that, like, what was I trying to show the world?
Well, but maybe there's some – you're trying to show reality?
That's what I thought. Well, and the other thing is, of course, every writer knows that you have very little control over what you're doing. If you start off with some master plan, which I always try, it falls apart. So it's not really in my hands, although that won't make sense to anyone who's like my mother. She always sees herself in my books, and I tell her she's not in them. She's definitely not in this one. Mom.
Well, because they think it is in your hands. It's your hands that are writing it, but you're saying...
I mean, I'm literally doing it, so who's to blame but me, I guess. But I feel like there's some other person to blame.
Well, the character. The character seems to be, you're saying, taking you in certain directions. Look, this could be seen also as commentary on the last half a century of, you know, the gay world. Because one of the reasons that Arthur's in a bit of a panic approaching 50s, he knew how to be young, a lot of parties, a lot of partners. He knows how to be old. He's seeing his former partner, the poet, you know, on that horizon. He doesn't know how to be 50 because he hasn't seen very many people become 50 because he's of the generation that was lost to AIDS.
Yeah. It's a funny thing to be in the middle of this sort of comic novel that something that I've thought about. I'm not quite 50 yet, let's just be clear. Mm-hmm. But I thought about a lot that the generation just ahead of me, we lost a lot of them, you know, tens of thousands. And so I have not seen a lot of men getting into 50, 60. It has been sad for decades, but it means that there's this whole lost group mm-hmm. and that could have taught me how to get old.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess we all have to figure it out in our own way.
Yeah. Well, as Arthur does. But not before he interviews a famous science fiction author, and Arthur shows up with a Russian cosmonaut's helmet, and he bought in a gay bar. It's a whole other story. he goes to an awards contest in Italy, so excited, but it's being judged by high school students. You know, you even relate that in his high school had an Arthur Less Day. Nobody shows up. Yes, that's extreme. But as a traveling author, are you trying to reflect on some of that? Oh, God, who's going to be here? Is anybody going to be here? That lifestyle.
Yes. Even friends of mine who were some of the most successful writers there are, I see them on book tour. I just saw some of them in Italy, and I watched little humiliations being built into even these wonderful events. Great writers who had this huge crowd in a piazza, and there were all these teenage girls in the front row who had filled the first couple rows, and they thought, wow, isn't this wonderful? The teenagers in Italy are reading. That they kept looking at their phones, and finally when the event was over, they realized that it was the next event they had gotten seats for, which was like a super pop star in Italy, 22-year-old. They were, of course, abashed, realizing that no one had come for them after all. And these are highly successful writers who felt a little humiliated by this event. Nobody's fault, but it's sort of part of the thing.
It's part of it. Well, I just, Andrew Sean Greer, just wondering, this is a person, I'm picturing someone I know when I read about Arthur Less.
Yeah.
Have you had people come up to you and say, well, I had no idea you thought that ill of me, or I had no idea you thought... I mean, are people recognizing themselves?
Usually, the people you are terrified are going to recognize themselves never do, because their vanity is too large to include the version of themselves that you see. And it's the people who aren't in there at all who are convinced they're they see themselves in every little character. Again, mother, you're not in this book.
Andrew Sean Greer, his new novel is Less. Did you find yourself, I mean, poor Arthur Less, as you said, making, you know, kind of making fun in some ways, trying to tear away every conceit that he has, every vanity that he has. But do you like him?
Oh, I really do. Yeah. I think if I didn't like him, it would be a cruel book. But I had such fun writing it, and I have such affection for him that I never really wanted him to suffer very much.
Well, as he said, it's really hard to feel bad for a white guy. But
yeah, that's part of it, too. You know, I thought, I think I can do anything to this one. And how much privilege can I strip away before he still has enough to get by, you know, anyway?
Well, we mentioned Homer, and dear future reader, don't worry. When he crawls back to his home in the last couple of pages, there is his reward. Andrew, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Robin Young spoke with Andrew Sean Greer about his Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Less last July. A warning to listeners, this next story is about sexual violence and a recent rape that has sparked violent protests this week in the disputed India state of Jammu and Kashmir. That's where police say an 8-year-old Muslim girl was kidnapped, drugged, gang-raped, and then murdered. This horrific crime, allegedly by Hindu men, occurred in January. But the case took a political turn after a mob recently tried to block police from filing charges. Two officials from Prime Minister Narendra Modi's ruling party were part of that mob, protesting in favor of the accused men. They have since resigned. And this is not the only rape case roiling India. A powerful member of the Prime Minister's party is accused of raping a teenage girl and conspiring to help kill the girl's father. Aruna Roy is an Indian activist. She joins us now by Skype from Dev Dungri. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for calling me.
Ms. Roy, you and a number of others have written a letter to the Prime Minister saying that this is our darkest hour. You've called the government's response to this feeble and inadequate. Explain that.
You see, in this case, in the case of Asifa, actually, the police and the administration took fairly decent action at fairly quickly. But what was unpredictable and awful was that there was a social pressure put on by the lawyers, by Hindu extremists on the administration. And the Prime Minister made no response for many months. And this is a moment, therefore, we call it a moment of existential crisis. And they are actually generating a kind of hate politics, which is extremely harmful to the country and to the social fabric and the moral fabric of our nation.
Ms. Roy, yesterday while in London, Prime Minister Modi addressed the issue saying, quote, a rape is a rape. How can we tolerate this torture with our daughters? You're saying that was too little, too late?
Well, your actions have to match what you say. And this is just too late. The rape happened in January. There was dead silence for 4 months. And a Hindu woman lawyer took up the case, and she has been threatened and attacked by the Bar Council in Jammu. And the people who have given the judgment, who have registered the case, and the police have all been Hindus. So it's not really a Hindu-Muslim issue. But this uprising of Hindu extremists and the Hindu right wing has actually made it, transformed it into a Muslim-Hindu issue. And really and truly, it's an issue of security for our children, security for young girls across all caste communities and everywhere in this country.
India is not the only country with a persistent problem with sexual violence, but in India, the violence is often quickly politicized along religious and ethnic lines. What more do you want to see from political leaders to stop that from happening?
See, actually, it boils down to quick remedies and quick implementation of the law and decent governance. And I'm afraid in the last 4 years, it has happened periodically. Rape always happens. But in the last 4 years, it's been given a communal hue, and the lynchings and all the various other and violent activities that have preceded these rapes have all been done by mobs. And the state is quiet. And this is a relatively new phenomenon in India. The last 4 years, it's really been on the increase.
We mentioned that two officials from the Prime Minister's party who protested to try to prevent the accused men from being charged Those officials say they want the investigation to be taken away from the state police, which they say has a pro-Muslim bias. Do you think the family of this murdered little girl will get justice?
Actually, it's so pitiable. If you see that family, it's a nomadic family, extremely poor, and they take their sheep and animals from pasture to pasture. They are really nomads. And the father of the child has said that she is India's daughter. She is not Hindu nor Muslim. She is a child who's been raped. She didn't know the meaning of these things. And they have been quite happy with the kind of actions taken by the local police. This diverting it to the CBI is a tactic to make it infructuous, because actually the Hindu mobilization took place because there was decent state action to arrest the perpetrators of the crime.
Some are calling for the death penalty. What do you want to see happen to these accused rapists?
Actually, you know, there is a whole big divide in India between wanting cessation of all this violence and the issue of death penalty. And death penalty is an issue on which I personally, and many of us like me, feel that death penalties do not stop criminality. If you take the rape law that was passed, say, 5 years ago by the previous government, which brought in death penalty as the punishment for rape, there should have been a dip in rape and crimes, sexual crimes, but it hasn't happened. So what we really need to stop these kinds of criminal action is for the state to be non-partisan, act according to constitutional fundamental guarantees, which guarantee a secular India. The perpetrators must be arrested and put in jail, and the process of law should be allowed to continue uninterrupted by these kinds of negative social elements.
Aruna Roy is an Indian activist. She joined us via Skype from Dev Dungri. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Eric Westervelt.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.